CNN. Good updating requires the same skills used in making the initial forecast and is often just as demanding. It can even be more challenging. The over-under. My fellow Americans, tonight I want to speak to you about what the United States will do with our friends and allies to degrade and ultimately destroy the terrorist group known as ISIL, President Obama said at the beginning of an address televised live on the evening of September 10, 2014. I've made it clear that we will hunt down terrorists who threaten our country, wherever they are. That means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq. Super forecasters took note. Whether a foreign military would carry out operations within Syria before December 1, 2014, was a live question in the tournament. This announcement made a yes all but certain. A flurry of updating followed. Like new polls showing a surge in support for a candidate, President Obama's announcement obviously called for an update. And what the update should be, a bump up to near certainty, was also obvious. But a development like this, and the response it calls for, are clear to everyone, and no one can produce superior forecasts only by staying on top of what everyone knows. What makes the difference is correctly identifying and responding to subtler information, so you zero in on the eventual outcome faster than others. Long after Bill Flack made his initial forecast on the Arafat polonium question, the Swiss research team announced that it would be late releasing its results because it needed to do more, unspecified, testing. What did that mean? It could be irrelevant. Maybe a technician had celebrated his birthday a little too heartily and missed work the next day. There was no way to find out. But by then, Bill knew a lot about polonium, including the fact that it can be found in a body as a result of it being introduced in that form, or it can be produced in the body when naturally occurring lead decays. To identify the true source, analysts remove all the polonium, wait long enough for more of the lead, if present, to decay into polonium, then test again. The Swiss team's delay suggested it had detected polonium and was now testing to rule out lead as its source. But that was only one possible explanation. So Bill cautiously raised his forecast to 65% yes. That's smart updating. Bill spotted subtly diagnostic information and moved the forecast in the right direction before everyone else, as the Swiss team did, in fact, find polonium in Arafat's remains. Bill's final Breyer score on this question was 0.36. That may not sound terribly impressive, but remember that Breyer scores only have meaning in relation to the difficulty of the problem at hand, and most experts were shocked by the results. At the close of trading, a prediction market operating inside the IARPA tournament put the probability of yes at a mere 4.27%, which translates into a Breyer score 5 times worse than Bill's. Given the difficulty of the problem, the fact that Bill mostly saw a positive test result as being more likely than not is truly impressive accuracy. But as Bill also demonstrated, even the best updaters make mistakes. In 2013, when IARPA asked whether the Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, would visit the Yasukuni Shrine, Bill strongly believed the answer was no. Yasukuni was founded in 1869 to honor Japan's war dead, and now lists almost 2.5 million soldiers. Conservatives like Abe revere it. But included among the names of the honored dead are those of about 1,000 war criminals, including 14 Class A criminals. Visits to Yasukuni by Japanese leaders outraged the Chinese and Korean governments, and the government of the United States, Japan's chief ally, constantly urges Japanese prime ministers not to damage relations this way. Looking at these facts, Bill thought Abe wouldn't go. That was a reasonable forecast. But then someone close to Abe said unofficially that he would. Time for an update? Bill thought it made so little sense for Abe to make the visit that he discounted the statement and didn't update. On December 26th, Abe visited Yasukuni, and Bill's Breyer score took a hit. These stories suggest that if you spot potentially insightful new evidence, you should not hesitate to turn the ship's wheel hard. But consider what happened when Doug Lorch sailed into the Arctic Ocean. On 15 September 2014, will the Arctic sea ice extent be less than that of 15 September 2013? IARPA asked that question on August 20, 2014. Even though it was only a 26-day forecast, it was a tough call. Scientists track Arctic sea ice with amazing precision, reporting results daily. And in mid-August 2014, the ice extent was almost exactly the same as it had been a year earlier. So would there be more or less ice on September 15th than a year earlier? Everyone from scientists to super forecasters agreed it would be close. Doug hedged his opening forecast. He took a prudent 55% position that, yes, there would be less ice than a year earlier. 2 days later, a member of Doug's team discovered a report from the Sea Ice Prediction Network. It was a gem. Scientists had made 28 separate projections using 4 different methods, and all but 3 predicted less ice in September 2014 than a year earlier. The only catch? The report was a month old. When you're dealing with a reality that changes daily, and the forecast only looks 28 days out, a month is a long time. Still, Doug told me, it was pretty darn convincing. Doug spun the ship's wheel hard to 95% yes. Over the next few weeks, ice loss slowed. On September 15th, there was more ice than a year earlier. Doug's score suffered for it. So there are 2 dangers a forecaster faces after making the initial call. One is not giving enough weight to new information. That's underreaction. The other danger is overreacting to new information, seeing it as more meaningful than it is, and adjusting a forecast too radically. Both under- and overreaction can diminish accuracy. Both can also, in extreme cases, destroy a perfectly good forecast. Under. Underreaction can happen for any number of reasons, some of them prosaic. Shoot. I have done a poor job of updating my forecast here, Joshua Frankel wrote after the U.S. Air Force attacked targets in Syria on September 22, 2014. Closing the question about whether foreign militaries would intervene in Syria before December 1, 2014. Frankel's mistake? Like everyone else, he saw Obama announce his intention to go after ISIL in Syria. But he didn't raise his forecast from 82% to 99%, as he later said he should have, because events unfolded quickly and he was too swamped with work to stay on top of it. Some updating does reduce to good housekeeping, sweeping out old forecasts. But there is a subtler explanation for Bill Flack's underreaction to a Japanese official saying Shinzo Abe would visit the Yasukuni Shrine. The political costs of visiting Yasukuni were steep, and Abe had no pressing need to placate his conservative constituents by going, so the benefit was negligible. Conclusion? Not going looked like the rational decision. But Bill ignored Abe's own feelings. Abe is a conservative nationalist. He had visited Yasukuni before, although not as prime minister. He wanted to go again. Reflecting on his mistake, Bill told me, I think that the question I was really answering wasn't, will Abe visit Yasukuni, but, if I were PM of Japan, would I visit Yasukuni? That's astute, and it should sound familiar. Bill recognized that he had unconsciously pulled a bait and switch on himself, substituting an easy question in place of a hard one. Having strayed from the real question, Bill dismissed the new information because it was irrelevant to his replacement question. That's an example of an updating error rooted in psychological bias. They are always a challenge to spot. But one psychological source of error is particularly tenacious and likely to produce forecast wrecking under reaction. On December 7, 1941, when the Japanese Imperial Navy attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor, Americans were shocked, not only because they had suddenly been thrust into World War II, but because the attack revealed a danger few had imagined. If Hawaii was vulnerable, so was California. Defenses were hurriedly bolstered, but many top officials worried that all their preparations could be undone by spies and saboteurs. Japanese Americans may well be the Achilles heel of the entire civilian defense effort, warned Earl Warren, At the time, Warren was Attorney General of California. Later, he became governor, then Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, and is remembered today as the liberal champion of school desegregation and civil rights. But civil rights were not at the tip of Warren's nose in World War II. Security was. His solution to the perceived threat was to round up and imprison every man, woman, and child of Japanese descent, a plan carried out between mid-February and August 1942, when 112,000 people, two-thirds of whom had been born in the United States, were shipped to isolated camps ringed with barbed wire and armed guards. There was no sabotage in the 10 weeks before the internment, or in the rest of 1942, or in 1943. Some advocates of internment felt that this evidence, and the major setbacks suffered by the Japanese military, meant the policy should be eased. Not Warren and other hardliners. The danger was real, and it had not lessened, they insisted. This is an extreme case of what psychologists call belief perseverance. People can be astonishingly intransigent and capable of rationalizing like crazy to avoid acknowledging new information that upsets their settled beliefs. Consider the 1942 argument of General John DeWitt, a strong supporter of the internment of Japanese Americans. The very fact that no sabotage has taken place to date is a disturbing and confirming indication that such action will be taken. Or, to put that more bluntly, the fact that what I expected to happen didn't happen proves that it will. Fortunately, such extreme obstinacy is rare. More commonly, when we are confronted by facts impossible to ignore, we budge, grudgingly, but the degree of change is likely to be less than it should be. As we saw in Chapter 2, the brain likes things neat and orderly, and once it has things that way, it tries to keep disturbances to a minimum. But not all disturbances are equal. Remember that Keynes quotation about changing your mind in light of changed facts? It's cited in countless books, including one written by me and another by my co-author. Google it and you will find it's all over the internet. Of the many famous things Keynes said, it's probably the most famous. But while researching this book, I tried to track it to its source and failed. Instead, I found a post by a Wall Street Journal blogger, which said that no one has ever discovered its provenance, and the two leading experts on Keynes think it is apocryphal. In light of these facts, and in the spirit of what Keynes apparently never said, I concluded that I was wrong, and I have now confessed to the world. Was that hard? Not really. Many smart people have made the same mistake, so it's not embarrassing to own up to it. The quotation wasn't central to my work, and being right about it wasn't part of my identity. But if I had staked my career on that quotation, my reaction might have been less casual. Social psychologists have long known that getting people to publicly commit to a belief is a great way to freeze it in place, making it resistant to change. The stronger the commitment, the greater the resistance. Jean-Pierre Bugams is a super forecaster who prides himself on his willingness to change my opinions a lot faster than my other teammates. But he also noted, it is a challenge, I'll admit that, especially if it's a question that I have a certain investment in. For Bugams, that means military questions. He is a graduate of West Point who is writing his PhD dissertation on American military history. I feel like I should be doing better than most on military questions, so if I realize that I'm wrong, I might spend a few days in denial about it before I critique myself. Commitment can come in many forms, but a useful way to think of it is to visualize the children's game Jenga, which starts with building blocks stacked one on top of another to form a little tower. Players take turns removing building blocks until someone removes the block that topples the tower. Our beliefs about ourselves and the world are built on each other in a Jenga-like fashion. My belief that Keynes said, "When the facts change, I change my mind," was a block sitting at the apex. It supported nothing else, so I could easily pick it up and toss it without disturbing other blocks. But when Jean-Pierre makes a forecast in his specialty, that block is lower in the structure. sitting next to a block of self-perception near the tower's core. So it's a lot harder to pull that block out without upsetting other blocks, which makes Jean-Pierre reluctant to tamper with it. The Yale professor Dan Kahan has done much research showing that our judgments about risks, does gun control make us safer or put us in danger, are driven less by a careful weighing of evidence than by our identities, which is why people's views on gun control often correlate with their views on climate change, even though the two issues have no logical connection to each other. Psychologic trumps logic. And when Kahan asks people who feel strongly that gun control increases risks or diminishes it, to imagine conclusive evidence that shows they are wrong, and then asks if they would change their position if that evidence were handed to them, they typically say no. That belief block is holding up a lot of others. Take it out and you risk chaos. So many people refuse to even imagine it. When a block is at the very base of the tower, there's no way to remove it without bringing everything crashing down. This extreme commitment leads to extreme reluctance to admit error, which explains why the men responsible for imprisoning 112,000 innocent people could be so dogged in their belief that the threat of sabotage was severe. Their commitment was massive. Warren was, deep down, a civil libertarian, admitting to himself that he had unjustly imprisoned 112,000 people would have taken a sledgehammer to his mental tower. This suggests that super forecasters may have a surprising advantage. They're not experts or professionals, so they have little ego invested in each forecast, except in rare circumstances. When Jean-Pierre Bugams answers military questions, for example, they aren't deeply committed to their judgments, which makes it easier to admit when a forecast is off track and adjust. This isn't to say that super forecasters have zero ego investment. They care about their reputations among their teammates. And if super forecaster becomes part of their self-concept, their commitment will grow fast. But still, the self-esteem stakes are far less than those for career CIA analysts or acclaimed pundits with their reputations on the line. And that helps them avoid underreaction when new evidence calls for updating beliefs. Over. Imagine you are a subject in an odd undergraduate psychology experiment. The researcher asks you to read a bit of information about someone. Robert is a student, it says. He studies about 31 hours each week. You are then asked to predict Robert's grade point average. It's not much to go on, but it matches your stereotype of a good student. So you guess his GPA is pretty high. Now try this one. David is a psychotherapy patient who is sexually aroused by violent sadomasochistic fantasies. Question: how likely is David to be a child abuser? Again, you have little information, but what you have fits your stereotype of child abusers. So you say there is a good chance he's one. Now suppose I gave you more facts about Robert. What if I told you he plays tennis 3 or 4 times a month, and the longest relationship he has had lasted 2 months? Would you change your estimate of Robert's GPA? And here's more information about David. He likes to tell jokes. He once injured his back while skiing. Now, is he more or less likely to be a child abuser? You may be thinking, all that additional information is irrelevant. I'd ignore it. And good for you. It was carefully preselected for its total irrelevance. And yet, irrelevant information of this sort does sway us. In 1989, building on work by the psychologist Richard Nisbet, I ran a study in which randomly selected participants got either the bare minimum facts or that information plus the irrelevant facts and then estimated Robert's GPA or David's proclivity for child abuse. As expected, those who got the irrelevant information lost confidence. Why? With nothing to go on but evidence that fits their stereotype of a good student or a child abuser, the signal feels strong and clear, and our judgment reflects that. But add irrelevant information, and we can't help but see Robert or David more as a person than a stereotype, which weakens the fit. Psychologists call this the dilution effect, and given that stereotypes are themselves a source of bias, we might say that diluting them is all to the good. Yes and no. Yes, it is possible to fight fire with fire, and bias with bias, but the dilution effect remains a bias. Remember what's going on here. People base their estimate on what they think is a useful tidbit of information. Then they encounter clearly irrelevant information, meaningless noise, which they indisputably should ignore. But they don't. They sway in the wind, at the mercy of the next random gust of irrelevant information. Such swaying is overreaction, a common and costly mistake. Look at a typical day in the stock market. The volume and volatility of trading are staggering. The reasons for that are complex and the subject of much research and debate, but it seems clear that at least some of it is due to traders overreacting to new information. Even John Maynard Keynes, he may not have said those famous words, but he really did urge people to change their minds in light of changing facts, felt that day-to-day fluctuations in the profits of existing investments, which are obviously of an ephemeral and non-significant character, tend to have an altogether excessive and even an absurd influence on the market. Many investors move from stock to stock or from mutual fund to mutual fund, as if they were selecting and discarding cards in a game of gin rummy, observed the Princeton economist Burton Malkiel, and they pay the price. Many studies have shown that those who trade more frequently get worse returns than those who lean toward old-fashioned buy-and-hold strategies. Malkiel cited one study of 66,000 American households over a 5-year period in the 1990s when the market had a 17.9% annual return. Households that traded the most had an annual return of only 11.4%. Massive time and effort went into those trades, and yet the people who made them would have been better off if they had gone golfing. As with underreaction, the key is commitment. In this case, the absence of commitment. Traders who constantly buy and sell are not cognitively or emotionally connected to their stocks. They expect some to fall, and they sell off these losers with a shrug. Malkiel's metaphor is apt. They are no more committed to these stocks than a gin rummy player is to the cards in his hand, leaving them free to overreact to information, obviously of an ephemeral and non-significant character. Given super forecasters' modest commitment to their forecasts, we would expect overreactions, like that of Doug Lorch and his team swinging from 55% to 95% on a single month-old report, to be a greater risk than underreactions. And yet, super forecasters often manage to avoid both errors. They wouldn't be super forecasters if they didn't. So how do they do it? In the 19th century, when prose was never complete without a sage aside to Greek mythology, any discussion of two opposing dangers called for Scylla and Charybdis. Scylla was a rock shoal off the coast of Italy. Charybdis was a whirlpool on the coast of Sicily, not far away. Sailors knew they would be doomed if they strayed too far in either direction. Forecasters should feel the same about under- and overreaction to new information. The Scylla and Charybdis of forecasting. Good updating is all about finding the middle passage. Captain Minto. In the third season of the IARPA tournament, Tim Minto won top spot with a final Breyer score of 0.15, an amazing accomplishment, almost in the league of Ken Jennings winning Jeopardy 74 games in a row. A big reason why the 45-year-old Vancouver software engineer did so well is his skill at updating. For his initial forecasts, Tim takes less time than some other top forecasters. I typically spend 5 to 15 minutes, which means maybe an hour or so total when a new batch of 6 or 7 questions come out, he said. But the next day he'll come back, take another look, and form a second opinion. He also trawls for contrary evidence on the internet, and he does this 5 days a week. All that exploration makes him change his mind a lot. I update constantly, he said. That's just the way my mind works, although more typically it applies to real work as opposed to tournament questions. By the time a question closes, Tim has usually made a dozen forecasts. Sometimes the total is closer to 40 or 50. On one question, whether the United States and Afghanistan would reach an agreement on the continued presence of American troops, he made 77 forecasts. It may look as though Captain Minto is sailing straight for the Charybdis of overreaction. But I haven't yet mentioned the magnitude of his constant course corrections. In almost every case, they are small, and that makes a big difference. As the Syrian civil war raged, displacing civilians in vast numbers, the IARPA tournament asked forecasters whether the number of registered Syrian refugees reported by the United Nations Refugee Agency as of 1 April 2014 would be under 2.6 million. That question was asked in the first week of January 2014, so forecasters had to look 3 months into the future. The answer turned out to be yes. Here is a chart of how Tim Minto updated his beliefs over those 3 months. Tim started off very slightly on the side of yes when the question opened, which made sense at the time. The target number was high, but the situation in Syria was bad, and the refugee numbers were rising daily. The chart tells the tale of what followed. Tim changed his forecast 34 times. While some of his new forecasts led him away from the correct answer, the trend was mostly in the right direction. Tim's final Brier score was an impressive 0.07. And notice how small Tim's changes are. There are no dramatic swings of 30 or 40 percentage points. The average update was tiny, only 3.5%. That was critical. A few small updates would have put Tim on a heading for underreaction. Many large updates could have tipped him toward overreaction. But with many small updates, Tim slipped safely between Scylla and Charybdis. It may seem strange to think in terms of such tiny changes, units of doubt, but if you think as granularly as Tim does, it comes naturally. Suppose that, in early September 2014, you read that Nate Silver, a prominent poll aggregator, gave Republicans a 60% chance of winning the Senate in the midterm elections. You find that convincing, so you set your initial forecast at 60%. The next day, you learn a new poll has found Republican support in Colorado's Senate race rising from 45% to 55%. How much should that news increase your estimate? It has to be more than zero. But then you think about how many other races have to tip in favor of the Republicans, and you realize that even a win in Colorado doesn't make a big difference. So you think the maximum you should raise your forecast is 10%. It's now between 1% and 10%. How many races look winnable for the Republicans? If the answer is lots more than needed to take a Senate majority, it suggests the higher end of that range. If it's barely enough to win a majority, it points toward the lower end. What are the polling trends in those races? Are the factors at work in Colorado relevant there? How far away is the election? How predictive have polls been this far in advance of the election? Each answer helps you to zero in a little more. It's between 2% and 9%, then 3% and 7%. Finally, you settle on 4%, and you raise your forecast from 60% to 64%. It's not dramatic. It's even, to be candid, a tad boring. Tim will never become a guru who shares his visionary insights and TV appearances, best-selling books, and corporate gigs. But Tim's way works. The tournament data prove it. Super forecasters not only update more often than other forecasters, they update in smaller increments. Why this works is no mystery. A forecaster who doesn't adjust her views in light of new information won't capture the value of that information, while a forecaster who is so impressed by the new information that he bases his forecast entirely on it will lose the value of the old information that underpinned his prior forecast. But the forecaster who carefully balances old and new captures the value in both and puts it into her new forecast. The best way to do that is by updating often, but bit by bit. An old thought experiment illustrates the idea. Imagine you are sitting with your back to a billiards table. A friend rolls a ball onto the table, and it stops at a random spot. You want to locate the ball without looking. How? Your friend rolls a second ball, which stops at another random spot. You ask, is the second ball to the left or the right of the first? Your friend says, to the left. That's an almost trivial scrap of information. But it's not nothing. It tells you that the first ball is not on the extreme left edge of the table. And it makes it just a tad more likely that the first ball is on the right side of the table. If your friend rolls another ball on the table, and the procedure is repeated, you get another scrap of information. If he says, it's to the left, the likelihood of the first ball being on the right side of the table increases a little more. Keep repeating the process, and you slowly narrow the range of possible locations, zeroing in on the truth, although you will never eliminate uncertainty entirely. If you've taken Statistics 101, you may recall a version of this thought experiment was dreamt up by Thomas Bayes. Presbyterian minister, educated in logic, Bayes was born in 1701, so he lived at the dawn of modern probability theory, a subject to which he contributed with An Essay Toward Solving a Problem in the Doctrine of Chances. That essay, in combination with the work of Bayes' friend Richard Price, who published Bayes' essay posthumously in 1761, and the insights of the great French mathematician Pierre-Simon Laplace, ultimately produced Bayes' theorem. It looks like this. Probability of H given D divided by probability of not H given D is equal to the product probability of D given H times probability of D given not H times probability of H divided by probability of not H. Posterior odds equal likelihood ratio times prior odds. The Bayesian belief updating equation. In simple terms, the theorem says that your new belief should depend on two things. Your prior belief, all the knowledge that informed it, multiplied by the diagnostic value of the new information. That's head-scratchingly abstract. So let's watch Jay Ohlfelder, political scientist, superforecaster, and colleague of mine, put it to concrete use. In 2013, the Obama administration nominated Chuck Hagel to be defense secretary, but controversial reports surfaced, and a hearing went badly, and some speculated that Hagel might not be confirmed by the Senate. Will Hagel withdraw? Wrote Tim Ricks, a defense analyst. I'd say 50-50. But declining by the day. Bottom line, every business day that the Senate Armed Services Committee doesn't vote to send the nomination to the full Senate, I think the likelihood of Hagel becoming defense secretary declines by about 2%. Was that a solid judgment? Experienced forecasters often start with the base rate. Ohlfelder wrote, since the establishment of the Secretary of Defense position soon after World War II, it looks like only one of 24 official nominees has been rejected by the Senate, and none has withdrawn. So the base rate is 96%. If Ohlfelder had been asked immediately after Chuck Hagel was nominated whether he would be confirmed, he would say, assuming he didn't factor in any other information, there is a 96% chance he will. Because this estimate is made prior to the arrival of more information, it is called the prior. But then Hagel botched the hearing. Clearly that reduced his chances. But by how much? To answer that, Ohlfelder wrote, Bayes' theorem requires us to estimate two things. One, how likely are we to see a poor Senate performance when the nominee is destined to fail, and two, how likely are we to see a poor performance when the nominee is bound for approval? Ohlfelder didn't have those numbers, so he started by giving Ricks the benefit of the doubt and tilting his estimates heavily in Ricks's favor, with the implication that if Ricks couldn't be vindicated with those numbers, he couldn't be vindicated. For the sake of argument, I'll assume that only one of every five nominees bound for success does poorly in confirmation hearings, but 19 of 20 bound for failure do. Ohlfelder plugged the numbers into Bayes' formula, did the math, and his forecast tumbles from 96% to a lowly 83%. Thus, Ohlfelder concluded Ricks's estimate was way off, and Hagel was still very likely to be confirmed. and he was 2 weeks later. This may cause the math-averse to despair. Do forecasters really have to understand, memorize, and use a, shudder, algebraic formula? For you, I have good news. No, they don't. The super forecasters are a numerate bunch. Many know about Bayes' theorem and could deploy it if they felt it was worth the trouble. But they rarely crunch the numbers so explicitly. What matters far more to the super forecasters than Bayes' theorem is Bayes' core insight of gradually getting closer to the truth by constantly updating in proportion to the weight of the evidence. That's true of Tim Minto. He knows Bayes' theorem, but he didn't use it even once to make his hundreds of updated forecasts. And yet, Minto appreciates the Bayesian spirit. I think it is likely that I have a better intuitive grasp of Bayes' theorem than most people, he said. Even though if you asked me to write it down from memory, I'd probably fail. Minto is a Bayesian who does not use Bayes' theorem. That paradoxical description applies to most superforecasters. So we have the winning formula. Lots of small updates. Do that and you will be on your way to forecasting glory, right? I wish it were that simple. True, Tim Minto's approach often works remarkably well, which is why it's common in superforecasters updating. But it is not a skeleton key that opens all locks. Sometimes it is exactly the wrong thing to do. Remember Doug Lorch's overreaction to the report about Arctic sea ice? Several days after he raised his forecast to 95% yes, he looked at the most recent data as well as data for the previous 12 years. When he compared the data with a scientist's projections, he saw a big and widening gap between the projections and reality. What should he do? Doug could follow the many small updates guideline and gradually lower his forecast as time passed. Or he could take a fresh look. The only reason I'm at 95% is a report that is clearly failing, so I should ditch the report and make a new forecast. He took the second opinion. First, he throttled back to 55%, which was his opening forecast. Then he dropped it to 15%. After that, Doug resumed many small updates, his usual style. It was the right call. If Doug had stuck with many small updates when he was at 95%, his disappointing final score would have been much worse. In his famous essay, Politics and the English Language, George Orwell concluded with six emphatic rules, including, never use a long word where a short one will do, and never use the passive where you can use the active. But the sixth rule was the key. Break any of these rules sooner than saying anything outright barbarous. I understand the desire for fail-safe rules that guarantee good results. It is the source of our fatal attraction to hedgehog pundits and their false certainty. But there is no magical formula. Just broad principles with lots of caveats. Super forecasters understand the principles, but also know that their application requires nuanced judgments, and they would rather break the rules than make a barbarous forecast.
Chapter 8. Perpetual Beta. Failure inspired Mary Simpson to become a super forecaster.
I really totally missed the 2007 lead up to the financial crisis, and that was frustrating to me because I have the background to understand what went wrong, Simpson said.
With a PhD in economics from Claremont Graduate University, Simpson had managed regulatory and financial affairs for the utility Southern California Edison before semi-retiring and working as an independent financial consultant in 2007, when the first rumblings of the crisis were felt. At the end of the year, the economy tipped into recession. Worse shocks were felt in the first half of 2008. But like most experts in her field, it wasn't until Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy on September 15, 2008, that Mary realized the magnitude of the crisis. It was too late. Her retirement savings cratered.
I really wanted to think more about forecasting, she recalled.
It wasn't only financial self-interest that made her want to improve her foresight. It was the sense that she should because, well, she could.
It's one of those things where you feel like, I should be better at this, Simpson heard about the Good Judgment Project and volunteered. And she became a very good forecaster, as her super forecaster status attests. The psychologist Carol Dweck would say Simpson has a growth mindset, which Dweck defines as believing that your abilities are largely the product of effort, that you can grow to the extent that you are willing to work hard and learn. Some people might think that's so obviously true it scarcely needs to be said. But as Dweck's research has shown, the growth mindset is far from universal. Many people have what she calls a fixed mindset, the belief that we are who we are and abilities can only be revealed, not created and developed. People with a fixed mindset say things like, "I'm bad at math," and see that as an immutable feature of who they are, like being left-handed or female or tall. This has serious consequences. The person who believes he is bad at math and always will be won't try hard to improve, because that would be pointless. And if he is compelled to study math, as we all are in school, he will take any setback as further proof that his limits have been revealed and he should stop wasting his time as soon as possible. Whatever potential he had for improvement will never be realized. Thus, the belief, "I am bad at math," becomes self-fulfilling. In one of many experiments Dweck devised to reveal the crippling powers of the fixed mindset, she gave relatively easy puzzles to fifth graders. They enjoyed them. She then gave the children harder puzzles. Some of the children suddenly lost interest and declined an offer to take the puzzles home. Others loved the harder puzzles even more than the easy ones. "Could you write down the name of these puzzles?" one child asked, "so my mom can buy me some more when these ones run out?" The difference between the two groups of children was not puzzle-solving talent. Even among equally adept children, some were turned off by the tougher challenge, while others were intrigued. The key factor was mindset. Fixed mindset kids gave up. Growth mindset kids knuckled down. Even when the fixed-minded try, they don't get as much from the experience as those who believe they can grow. In one experiment, Dweck scanned the brains of volunteers as they answered hard questions. Then were told whether their answers were right or wrong, and given information that could help them improve. The scans revealed that volunteers with a fixed mindset were fully engaged when they were told whether their answers were right or wrong, but that's all they apparently cared about. Information that could help improve their answers didn't engage them. Even when they'd gotten an answer wrong, they were not interested in learning what the right answer was, Dweck wrote. Only people with a growth mindset paid close attention to information that could stretch their knowledge. Only for them was learning a priority. To be a top-flight forecaster, a growth mindset is essential. The best illustration is the man who is reputed to have said, but didn't, "When the facts change, I change my mind." Consistently inconsistent. Famous today only for his work on macroeconomic theory, one of John Maynard Keynes's many remarkable accomplishments was his success as an investor. From the end of World War I to the end of World War II, Keynes handled his own money as well as that of family and friends, two British insurance companies, various investment funds, and Cambridge University's King's College. When he died in 1946, Keynes was an extremely wealthy man, and those whose money he had managed had flourished beyond all reasonable expectation. It would be an impressive record in any era, but this wasn't just any era. Britain's economy stagnated in the 1920s. In the 1930s, the whole world staggered through the Great Depression. Considering that Keynes was investing during some of the worst years in history, his returns are astounding, noted John F. Wasik, the author of a book on Keynes's investments. Keynes was breathtakingly intelligent and energetic, which certainly contributed to his success, but more than that, he was an insatiably curious man who loved to collect new ideas, a habit that sometimes required him to change his mind. He did so ungrudgingly. Indeed, he took pride in his willingness to squarely admit mistakes and adopt new beliefs, and he urged others to follow his lead. "There is no harm in being sometimes wrong, especially if one is promptly found out," he wrote in 1933. Keynes is always ready to contradict not only his colleagues, but also himself whenever circumstances make this seem appropriate, reported a 1945 profile of the consistently inconsistent economist. So far from feeling guilty about such reversals of position, he utilizes them as pretext for rebukes to those he saw as less nimble-minded. Legend says that while conferring with Roosevelt at Quebec, Churchill sent Keynes a cable reading, "I'm coming around to your point of view." His lordship replied, "Sorry to hear it. Have started to change my mind." Keynes's record as an investor was far from unblemished. In 1920, he was nearly wiped out when his foreign currency forecasts turned out to be horribly wrong. He found his footing again and made a fortune for himself and others in the 1920s. But just like Mary Simpson in 2008, Keynes didn't see the disaster of 1929 coming, and he again lost big. But he bounced back and did even better than before. For Keynes, failure was an opportunity to learn, to identify mistakes, spot new alternatives, and try again. After his bad currency calls, Keynes didn't retreat to the safe and easy. He embraced new ideas in the early 1920s, like getting stodgy King's College into stocks at a time when institutions usually stuck to investments like real estate. When he was blindsided by the crash of 1929, he subjected his thinking to withering scrutiny. Keynes concluded that there was something wrong with one of his key theoretical assumptions. Stock prices do not always reflect the true value of companies. So an investor should study a company thoroughly and really understand its business, capital, and management when deciding whether it had sufficient underlying value to make an investment for the long term worthwhile. In the United States, about the same time, this approach was developed by Benjamin Graham, who called it value investing. It became the cornerstone of Warren Buffett's fortune. The one consistent belief of the consistently inconsistent John Maynard Keynes was that he could do better. Failure did not mean he had reached the limits of his ability. It meant he had to think hard and give it another go. Try, fail, analyze, adjust, try again. Keynes cycled through those steps ceaselessly. Keynes operated on a higher plane than most of us, but that process, try, fail, analyze, adjust, try again, is fundamental to how all of us learn, almost from the moment we are born. Look at a baby learning to sit up. She's wobbly at first, and when she tilts her head back to have a good long look at the ceiling fan, boom, back she goes onto the pillow her mother placed there, because babies learning to sit up always flop backward. The mother could skip the drama by putting her baby on her back or in a chair, but she knows that when her baby flops, she learns that she shouldn't tilt her head that far, and the next time she sits up, she will be a little steadier. The baby will still have to practice this new skill to make it reliable, then habitual, but the initial flop delivers the conceptual breakthrough. The same process plays out thousands of times during childhood, from standing to walking to getting on a school bus to figuring out how to manipulate the two joysticks and all those buttons so the character in the video game leaps at precisely the right moment with exactly the speed necessary to snatch the jewel and score 1,000 points. Adults do it too. The middle-aged accountant who picks up a golf club for the first time is like a baby learning to sit up. And even with professional instruction, he will fail often before he can pass as a competent golfer at the club. We learn new skills by doing. We improve those skills by doing more. These fundamental facts are true of even the most demanding skills. Modern jet fighters are enormously complex flying computers. But classroom instruction isn't enough to produce a qualified pilot. Not even time in advanced flight simulators will do. Pilots need hours in the air, the more the better. The same is true of surgeons, bankers, and business executives. Try. To demonstrate the limits of learning from lectures, the great philosopher and teacher, Michael Polanyi, wrote a detailed explanation of the physics of riding a bicycle. The rule observed by the cyclist is this. When he starts falling to the right, he turns the handlebars to the right, so that the course of the bicycle is deflected along a curve towards the right. This results in a centrifugal force pushing the cyclist to the left and offsets the gravitational force dragging him down to the right. It continues in that vein and closes. A simple analysis shows that for a given angle of unbalance, the curvature of each winding is inversely proportional to the square of the speed at which the cyclist is proceeding. It is hard to imagine a more precise description. But does this tell us exactly how to ride a bicycle? Polanyi asked. No, you obviously cannot adjust the curvature of your bicycle's path in proportion to the ratio of your unbalance over the square of your speed. And if you could, you would fall off the machine. For there are a number of other factors to be taken into account in practice, which are left out in the formulation of this rule. The knowledge required to ride a bicycle can't be fully captured in words and conveyed to others. We need tacit knowledge, the sort we only get from bruising experience. To learn to ride a bicycle, we must try to ride one. It goes badly at first. You fall to one side, you fall to the other. But keep at it, and with practice, it becomes effortless. Although if you had to explain how to stay upright, so they can skip the ordeal you just went through, you would succeed no better than Polanyi. This is blindingly obvious. It should be equally obvious that learning to forecast requires trying to forecast. Reading books on forecasting is no substitute for the experience of the real thing. Fail. But not all practice improves skill. It needs to be informed practice. You need to know which mistakes to look out for, and which best practices really are best. So don't burn your books. As noted earlier, randomized controlled experiments have shown that mastering the contents of just one tiny booklet, our training guidelines, see the appendix, can improve your accuracy by roughly 10%. These experiments have also shown how the effects of book knowledge interact with those of practice. People who read the booklet benefited more from practice, and people who practiced benefited more from reading the booklet. Fortune favors the prepared mind. The training guidelines help us draw the right lessons from our personal experiences and to strike the right balance between the outside and inside views. And our personal experiences help us infuse pallid public knowledge abstractions with real-world content. Effective practice also needs to be accompanied by clear and timely feedback. My research collaborator, Don Moore, points out that police officers spend a lot of time figuring out who is telling the truth and who is lying. But research has found they aren't nearly as good at it as they think they are, and they tend not to get better with experience. That's because experience isn't enough. It must be accompanied by clear feedback. When an officer decides that a suspect is or isn't lying, the officer doesn't get immediate feedback about the accuracy of her guess, like the suspect saying, "You're right, I was lying." Instead, events proceed. Charges may be laid, a trial held, and a verdict delivered. Or there may be a plea bargain down the road. But this can take months or years, and even when there is a resolution, a huge range of factors could have gone into it. So an officer seldom gets clear feedback that tells her, yes, her judgment was right, or no, it was wrong. Predictably, psychologists who test police officers' ability to spot lies in a controlled setting find a big gap between their confidence and their skill. And that gap grows as officers become more experienced and they assume, not unreasonably, that their experience has made them better lie detectors. As a result, officers grow confident faster than they grow accurate, meaning they grow increasingly overconfident. Gaps like that are far from unusual. Research on calibration, how closely your confidence matches your accuracy, routinely finds people are too confident. But overconfidence is not an immutable law of human nature. Meteorologists generally do not suffer from it. Neither do seasoned bridge players. That's because both get clear, prompt feedback. The meteorologist who calls for torrential rain tomorrow will know he was off if he wakes to sunshine. Bridge players, who estimate how many tricks they will win, get results at the end of each hand. If their forecasts fail, they know it. That is essential. To learn from failure, we must know when we fail. The baby who flops backward does. So does the boy who skins his knee when he falls off the bike, and the accountant who puts an easy putt into a sand trap. And because they know, they can think about what went wrong, adjust, and try again. Unfortunately, most forecasters do not get the high-quality feedback that helps meteorologists and bridge players improve. There are two main reasons why. Ambiguous language is a big one. As we saw in Chapter 3, vague terms like probably and likely make it impossible to judge forecasts. When a forecaster says something could or might or may happen, she could or might or may be saying almost anything. The same is true of countless other terms, like Steve Ballmer's reference to significant market share, that may sound precise, but on close inspection prove as fuzzy as fog. Even an impartial observer would struggle to extract meaningful feedback from vague forecasts, but often the judge is the forecaster herself. That makes the problem even worse. Consider the Fohr effect, named for the psychologist Bertram Fohr, who asked some students to complete a personality test, then gave them individual personality profiles based on the results, and asked how well the test captured their individual personalities. People were impressed by the test, giving it an average rating of 4.2 out of 5, which was remarkable, because Fohr had actually taken vague statements like, "You have a great need for people to like and admire you," from a book on astrology, assembled them into a profile, and given the same profile to everyone. Vague language is elastic language. The students stretched it to fit their self-images, even though they thought they were judging the test objectively. The lesson for forecasters who would judge their own vague forecasts is, don't kid yourself. The second big barrier to feedback is time lag. When forecasts span months or years, the wait for a result allows the flaws of memory to creep in. You know how you feel now about the future, but as events unfold, will you be able to recall your forecast accurately? There's a good chance you won't. Not only will you have to contend with ordinary forgetfulness, you are likely to be afflicted by what psychologists call hindsight bias. If you are old enough now to have been a sentient being in 1991, answer this question. Back then, how likely did you think it was that the incumbent president, George H.W. Bush, now known as Bush 41, would win re-election in 1992? We all know Bush 41 lost to Bill Clinton, but you may recall that he was popular after the victory in the Gulf War. So perhaps you thought his chances were pretty good, but obviously, he also stood a pretty good chance of losing. Maybe it was 50-50? Or maybe you thought the war gave him the edge, with, say, a 60% or 70% chance of winning. In fact, your memory of your judgment is very likely wrong, and in a predictable direction. I can demonstrate by dredging from the archives a 1991 Saturday Night Live skit that captured the received political wisdom in 1991. The scene: a debate among the leading candidates for the Democratic nomination in 1992. Moderator: "Good evening, I'm Faye Sullivan of the League of Women Voters. Welcome to this, the first in a series of debates among the five leading Democrats who are trying to avoid being forced by their party into a hopeless race against President George Bush. Most of them have already announced that they're not interested in the nomination, but each, of course, is under enormous pressure to be the chump who will take on the futile task of running against this very, very popular incumbent. They are Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey. Senator Bill Bradley: I am not a candidate for president in 1992. Moderator: House Majority Leader Dick Gephardt of Missouri. Congressman Dick Gephardt: I do not seek my party's nomination. It gets progressively more absurd. In this debate, each candidate heaps praise on his opponents while savaging himself, because Bush 41 was certain to crush whomever he faced. Everyone knew that. It's why leading Democrats didn't contest the nomination that year, clearing the way for the obscure governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton. Once we know the outcome of something, that knowledge skews our perception of what we thought before we knew the outcome. That's hindsight bias. Baruch Fischoff was the first to document the phenomenon in a set of elegant experiments. One had people estimate the likelihood of major world events at the time of Fischoff's research. Will Nixon personally meet with Mao? Then recall their estimate after the event did or did not happen. Knowing the outcome consistently slanted the estimate, even when people tried not to let it sway their judgment, The effect can be subtle, but it can also be quite big. In 1988, when the Soviet Union was implementing major reforms that had people wondering about its future, I asked experts to estimate how likely it was that the Communist Party would lose its monopoly on power in the Soviet Union in the next 5 years. In 1991, the world watched in shock as the Soviet Union disintegrated. So in 1992-93, I returned to the experts, reminded them of the question in 1988, and asked them to recall their estimates. On average, the experts recalled a number 31 percentage points higher than the correct figure. So an expert who thought there was only a 10% chance might remember herself thinking there was a 40% or 50% chance. There was even a case in which an expert who pegged the probability at 20% recalled it as 70%, which illustrates why hindsight bias is sometimes known as the "I knew it all along" effect. Forecasters who use ambiguous language and rely on flawed memories to retrieve old forecasts don't get clear feedback, which makes it impossible to learn from experience. They are like basketball players doing free throws in the dark. The only feedback they get are sounds: the clang of the ball hitting metal, the thunk of the ball hitting the backboard, the swish of the ball brushing against the net. A veteran who has taken thousands of free throws with the lights on can learn to connect sounds to baskets or misses, but not the novice. A swish may mean a nothing but net basket or a badly underthrown ball. A loud clunk means the throw hit the rim, but did the ball roll in or out? They can't be sure. Of course, they may convince themselves they know how they are doing, but they don't really. And if they throw balls for weeks, they may become more confident. I've practiced so much, I must be excellent. But they won't get better at taking free throws. Only if the lights are turned on can they get clear feedback. Only then can they learn and get better. When Tim Minto forecast Syrian refugee flows in 2014, he got a Breyer score of 0.07. That is clear, precise, and meaningful. An excellent result, the forecasting equivalent of a nothing but net free throw. Less happily, Tim's forecast on whether Shinzo Abe would visit the Asukuni Shrine scored a 1.46, which was like throwing the ball into the trash can at the back of the gymnasium. And Tim knew it. There was no ambiguity in the language to hide behind. No way hindsight bias could subtly fool him into believing his forecast wasn't so bad. Tim blew it, and he knew it, which gave him the chance to learn. By the way, there are no shortcuts. Bridge players may develop well-calibrated judgment when it comes to bidding on tricks, but research shows that judgment calibrated in one context transfers poorly, if at all, to another. So if you were thinking of becoming a better political or business forecaster by playing bridge, forget it. To get better at a certain type of forecasting, that is the type of forecasting you must do, over and over again, with good feedback telling you how your training is going, and a cheerful willingness to say, "Wow, I got that one wrong. I'd better think about why." Analyze and adjust. We agreed as a team that the half-life of polonium would make detection virtually impossible. We didn't do nearly enough to question that assumption. For example, by considering whether the decay products would be a way to detect polonium, or by asking someone with expertise in the area. That's a message Devin Duffy posted for his teammates after he and his team took a drubbing on the question about whether Yasser Arafat's remains would test positive for polonium. The lesson he drew? Be careful about making assumptions of expertise. Ask experts if you can find them. Re-examine your assumptions from time to time. Whenever a question closes, it's obvious that super forecasters, in sharp contrast to Carol Dweck's fixed mindset study subjects, are as keen to know how they can do better as they are to know how they did. Sometimes they share lengthy postmortems with teammates. These online discussions can go on for pages, and there's a lot more introspection when super forecasters have quiet moments to themselves. I do that while I'm in the shower or during my morning commute to school or work, Jean-Pierre Bugum says, or at random moments during the day when I'm bored or distracted. In the first two seasons of the tournament, Jean-Pierre would often look at his old forecasts and be frustrated that his comments were so sparse that I often could not figure out why I made a certain forecast, and thus couldn't reconstruct his thought